Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of August 5th, 2011. If you need a reason for doing something with your money besides putting it under the mattress, well, here you go.
Goods that it would take you about $5,000 today will actually cost you $11,000 25 years from now.
That means investing, and we'll tell you how to do it on a shoestring, even in a market like this. The new normal is all about working longer, probably resting less. So how about taking an unlimited vacation?
It came out of the blue on April 1st. They decided to let us know that we had an unlimited paid time off.
Yeah, I want to work there. And from family vacations to family loans, all we can say is, uh-oh.
He's the one that brought up interest. He's the one that brought up, you know, writing out contracts, but then didn't insist on any of it.
And oh, how he should have. Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
What a week, huh? How y'all doing? Well, if you listened to last week's show, then hopefully you remembered that markets go up and markets go down. It's what they do, and panic is not your friend. We will get to Wall Street's mania in a few minutes, but first, a far more important and lasting set of numbers. Friday's jobs report was better than expected, but there are lots of caveats. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman joins us with the details. Thanks for helping us out.
You're welcome, Tess.
Give us a rundown of the numbers.
Well, given what's been happening with the economy, no one was expecting much job growth in July. We've had a summer of falling consumer spending and consumer confidence. Basically, service and manufacturing businesses stalled out, not growing at all. So there's really no reason to add workers for companies. And then we get 117,000 new jobs in July and unemployment actually falling a bit. Though it is still above 9%, and some of that decline in the unemployment rate actually came from people giving up on the job hunt rather than finding work finally. And then government has been cutting jobs. It's now 9 straight months. That's because of budget cuts at state and local government. And another 37,000 jobs were cut in July.
I was hoping you weren't going to have a but in there, but I guess this is not such great news after all.
You know, one jobs report can't really undo months of incredibly weak job creation.
Yeah.
Since May, we've added just about 70,000 jobs a month on average. Economists say we need at least double that. That's just to keep up with all the people who enter the workforce just in the normal course of events. So what happened is, you know, the dust cleared this week from the horrible debt ceiling fight, and we got the lousy economy back.
Yeah.
Here's how Gary Burtless sees things. He's a labor economist at the Brookings Institution.
Resolving the debt ceiling impasse saved us from a great disaster. But the fact of the matter is the country was ill before that, and we remain ill afterward. The economy is still just growing very, very tepidly and not fast enough to reduce the ranks of the unemployed.
All right, Mitchell, I'm going to toss it back to you and ask for any light at the end of this tunnel, any bright spots here?
Well, it looks like the tunnel at least has light in it.
That's a plus.
Right. You know, private companies are continuing to hire. People are finding jobs in healthcare, retail, even manufacturing. The problem, Tess, is that there are more clouds on the horizon. First off, August has started off terribly, market panic and the debt crisis. And so employers may already be cutting back on hiring, and we won't know that for a while. Then at the end of the year, Congress is going to have to make some big decisions about whether to continue paying extended unemployment benefits to millions of people, also whether to extend the payroll tax cut. Ultimately, I don't think the job situation can really get better until the rest of the economy does. So it kind of all has to happen together.
All right. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman joining us from Portland, Oregon. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
So as Mitchell mentioned, the long-term unemployment situation is the really scary part of all this, and it's a major element in a new book by our next guest. Don Peck is the author of Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tess.
I'd like you to start by reading a passage in your book where we meet Gus, and Gus is a former senior financial analyst who lost a job, and he now finds himself working as a cashier at Walmart. Can you start there?
Absolutely. Gus Polos' wife was still working, and that had been a blessing. But both were feeling the strain, financial and emotional, of his situation. She commutes about 100 miles every weekday, which makes for long days. His hours at Walmart were on weekends, so he didn't see her much anymore and didn't have much of a social life. Some neighbors were at the Walmart a couple of weeks earlier, he said, and he rang up their purchase. Maybe they were used to seeing me in a different setting, he said, in a suit as he left for work in the morning or walking the dog in the neighborhood. Or maybe they were daydreaming. But they didn't greet him, and he didn't say anything. He looked down at his soup, pushing it around the bowl with his spoon for a few seconds before looking back up at me. I know they knew me, he said. I've been in their home.
Not an uncommon story these days.
It isn't. The average duration of unemployment now is over 9 months, and millions of people have been unemployed for a year or 2 years or more. And I think that what Gus's story shows is not just the financial loss that results from unemployment, but the psychological loss. Happiness researchers have shown that being out of work for 6 months or more is really the worst thing that can happen to you psychologically. It's the psychological equivalent of losing a spouse. So today in the U.S., we have millions of people who are in exactly that situation, and millions more with each year that goes by before we find recovery. And one of the big questions for the U.S., I think, is not just how do we recover, but even once we recover, what are we going to do to get these people who have become chronically unemployed, whose behavior has changed, whose skills have eroded, what are we going to do to get them back into the workplace?
And I think what Gus really represents as well is folks have had to make such a tough decision to change their dreams, to change what they believed their trajectory would be.
He told me that one of his very first jobs was as a cashier in a supermarket. And here he was again, 40, 50 years later. So it certainly wasn't something that he had ever expected. But now it is what he expects. He's recognized that he's probably not going to find something better. And this is what he's going to have to do until his retirement.
You completely recalibrate what your expectation is going to be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that process is underway for people who are young, who are just starting out their careers. You know, when I first started the reporting for this book, I really expected that the recession would affect young people least of all. But what academic research shows is just the opposite. The first few years in the workforce is essential to establishing one's career track. And many young people have been unable to do that. They're in bad jobs or they're not working at all. And when that happens, people acquire a stigma that's hard to shed. People who graduate into recessions not only start behind, research shows they never catch up.
And I guess one of the questions that you have to ask out of that is what that means for the future. If you've got this younger generation that has experienced this rocking of their financial world and suddenly has this basically a different worldview, what does that do to them down the line?
Well, in the Depression, men actually, not women, but men who experienced hardship in their 20s never really did fully recover. I mean, not just financially, but emotionally and psychologically. Even in their 60s, they retained a sense of fatalism, of lack of agency, a sense of helplessness. It stuck with them through their whole career, through booms and busts.
So how does this play out in the long term? What lessons do you think we have learned or not learned from being pinched? What do we need to do?
You know, it's interesting. We just saw the raising of the debt ceiling and saw some measures to reduce the deficit. And I understand that sentiment. But interestingly, what you see is psychologically, whenever we have a big bust, people become extremely concerned about government spending and government deficits. We do need to address the debt in the long term, but reducing the deficit today is really just about the worst step that we can take. You know, one of the main reasons that we're still in such a weak period is that consumers are extremely indebted and are slowly rebuilding their personal finances. That process is nowhere near complete. And we really do need government spending to pick up the slack over the next couple of years to create demand and to get people back to work.
Don Peck is the author of Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Tess.
So, about the stock market. Loyal listeners to this program will know exactly what's coming out of my mouth next. One day, one week, one month does not an investment strategy make. But don't just take it from me. Take it from these friends of the show, starting with our New York Bureau Chief, Heidi Moore. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, Tess.
All right. Tell me, what are you doing with your money?
It is primarily under my mattress. It's a very safe bank.
Not if you have a house fire.
It's true, but you know, we'll probably have a fire in the market well before my house fire. Actually, I'm keeping it in very safe places. It's in my 401k where I can't sell it. I own some real estate, and for the most part, you know, when there's a panic like this, I like to not freak out and not touch my money because things can only go down when you start fiddling with the controls.
Well, I hope you can sleep with all the lumps under your mattress.
Thank you. They're much better in dollars than in peas, certainly.
Wisdom from one of the smartest people I know, Heidi Moore, in our New York Bureau. And next to one of the other smartest people that I know, Ron Lieber, personal finance writer at the New York Times. What are you doing with your money?
Well, the first thing I'm doing is I'm resisting the temptation to flee in terror from government legislators and regulators who do not know what they're doing and are unwilling to make the hard choices. It is tempting to take all of my money in stocks and put it in emerging markets or hide it someplace. But I know that I can't predict what's going to happen and that it just doesn't make sense to try and play the short term. This is long-term money. The other thing I'm doing is I'm going to the farmer's market on Saturday and I'm spending a lot of money on tomatoes. Tis the season. There are only 8 weeks around these parts, and I'm going to have a lot of tomato sandwiches.
You going to have some basil with that?
The basil is growing on the balcony.
All right. Thanks, Ron.
You got it.
Ron Lieber speaking with us from New York and the New York Times. And finally, from across the pond, we have Felix Salmon, blogger at Reuters, joining us from Sweden, of all places. Hi, Felix.
Hi, Tess.
Tell us what you're doing with your money.
I think I should keep on throwing it into the stock market. I feel that this is my big opportunity to buy more stocks with every dollar. They're on sale right now. This is a good thing, right?
So this is not the time to panic?
No. If you're going to panic every time the stocks go up or down in the course of a day, you should not be in stocks at all. The fact is the stocks are much higher now, or they're at least higher now than they were a year ago. They're still going up in the grand scheme of things. So if you obsess about what's going on in any one given day, you'll miss the big picture moves, whether up or down.
All right. I would say goodbye to you in Swedish, but I don't know how. So bye.
Bye, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. It is that time in the show when we take your money questions. And helping us out this week is MSN's Liz Pulliam-Weston. Hey, Liz.
Hey, Tess.
So, debt ceiling, anybody? Are we tired of talking about this? Can we leave it alone now? Apparently, we can't. Because what has happened over the last week with this deal is that there are some things that are going to affect all of us. So, let's start with what seems to be this continuing overhang of concern about the rating, the AAA rating, and whether this is going to change. If it does, how does that affect us?
Well, it makes paying back our debt more expensive. And I hope the folks that said, hey, we should just default and you know, stick it to the man. I have no idea what the idea or the reasoning behind that was. but the idea was that, you know, we shouldn't care about default. Well,
right.
Here is the result. If you default, then you pay more on the debt you already have. It becomes harder to pay back your debt. And if we have a ratings downgrade, same thing.
What does that mean for the rest of us? Interest rates possibly changing?
Well, I think we were going to see higher interest rates eventually anyway because
they have nowhere to go but
exactly,
up, first of all. Yeah.
They've been at generational lows. So, but if we do see a downgrade in our credit rating, then yeah, you'll see Treasury bonds probably more expensive. You could see that radiating out into the rest of the economy. And it would not be a good thing because, you know, these low interest rates mean that debt is fairly cheap and easy to pay back. When you raise the rate, you're going to have a harder time paying it back.
Well, a lot of people didn't get what they wanted out of this. Some people did. But it's clear that there are going to have to be some deeper changes down the line. We did not really deal with the massive deficit that we have. So what's in the future? Can you look in a crystal ball? What are they going to cut?
Mine is on the blink again, darn it. But here's the thing. This was political theater. It really didn't make a big change or really solve the problem. What we have to look at going forward is how are we really going to solve this problem of the deficit? And with a personal finance budget, the family budget, you do two things. You trim spending and you increase revenue. You get another job. You sell stuff.
Right.
And I think going forward, we're going to have to look at how we tax. You know, if not raising the overall tax rate, changing the way we tax things. One of the things that's come up is perhaps changing the way we give tax breaks on mortgages.
Right, that the mortgage interest deduction could potentially go away.
I don't think it will go away entirely, but it might be limited. Right now, it's limited to the first $1 million of your mortgage. You can deduct interest on that. Maybe they'll drop that limit to $500,000. But there are going to have to be some give and takes along the way.
I guess we'll wait and see for the next crisis to come along. Meantime, folks, as we said last week, just stay calm. Let's head to the phones. And Sage is with us from San Diego, California. Hi, Sage.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well. How are you?
I'm doing good.
So what did you think of this whole debt ceiling debacle?
It was kind of a gong show.
I like that.
You know what I mean? It seems like there was a lot of behind-the-doors talks, and then they would come out, and then it was just completely, like you guys said, theater. And it'd be interesting to know what's actually going on, you know what I mean?
Right. Did you take any action yourself as this whole thing was coming down?
No, I thought of it this way. You know, the Dow was at 6,000 2 years ago, and now it's at 12. So if you're kind of thinking long term, I mean, at this point, you're doing great, right?
Exactly. And that's the point I made on the show last week, Liz, which was, you know, the last time we got these kind of panicky letters from listeners was when the Dow was down at 6,500, you know, about a year and a half ago. Same lesson. This is temporary.
Yeah. Look at where the Dow was in the 60s. Look at where it was in the 40s. You know, over time, it does just plug ahead one way or another. But it can be very scary, especially if you've just been through this. And I think that was the problem, is a lot of people in 2008, 2009 got the pants scared off them. And maybe they hung on then, but maybe they were thinking, you know what? I don't want to do that again.
Yeah.
You know, and so they're panicking now, or they were panicking.
All right. So no panicking. Sage, what do you do there in San Diego?
I just moved from San Diego to Phoenix 2 days ago.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. I'm switching careers. I was a civil engineer and signed up for grad school, and I'm going for solar engineering and commercialization at ASU.
Ah, you're getting into the sustainability racket.
I'm swinging for the fences.
Nice. So is this about student loans then, let me guess?
Yeah, kind of. I actually received a fellowship to go to school, so school is mostly paid for. So I saved up as much money as I could. But what I'm actually feeling guilty about is my IRA.
feeling guilty about an IRA.
Let's see if we can absolve that.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it's like, okay, you go to school when I graduated like 24.
Mm-hmm.
And then I spent a lot of time paying off debt. And then I'm 28, and I realize I've really only put about $1,000 in my IRA a year. And it's looking like I'm going to have to put it off here with this quitting my job and going back to school for another 3 years. And so my question kind of was, since I don't particularly need the money, could I take out an extra $5,000 in student loans and just dump it in my IRA now?
Ow. Oh, geez. borrow to start your retirement fund? That's not how you want to get that done. Well, first of all, what's your debt situation? Have you basically taken care of all those issues that you mentioned?
Yeah, I'm completely debt-free. I have a car loan.
And you said you paid off your student loans?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Liz, what do you think?
I totally get where he's coming from. And I'm going to say guilt about not saving for retirement is a good thing to have.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing. You've been focusing on paying off your debt, which is really terrific. But the problem is you can't make up for lost time. And when it comes to retirement savings, every $1,000 you don't put aside in your 20s is going to cost you $10,000 to $20,000 in lost future retirement income. So there's a reason you're feeling that guilt. I will
not absolve it. You're not assuaging it yet.
I am not assuaging it, because really we want people in their 20s to get this message.
Right.
They've got to save for retirement, even if it means slowing down on the debt payment.
So my thinking with this whole putting $5,000 out in student loans when I have school paid for and my living's relatively low and I'm looking for a job now is that if interest rates are going to be around 1%, 2% in a year when I have to consolidate the loan, it almost seems kind of worth it. But no, you're saying absolutely not, huh?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. You don't want to be taking out private student loans, period, if you haven't exhausted the federal student loans. And private student loans are kind of like credit card debt. except you can't discharge it in bankruptcy.
Right.
With the federal student loans, the rates are going to be higher. What I would do is just make it a priority when you get out there, get done with school, to really start socking it away. And if you do have any credit card debt, which I hope you don't have, making sure that you're not stinting your retirement to pay off any debt. And retirement accounts, it really is use it or lose it.
I know. I just thought maybe I could slide by with some low interest rates. And...
Nope, we're not letting you slide by.
Fair enough.
No slide.
Okay.
Good luck, Sage.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks for the call. Bye-bye. All right, next we have Summer in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Summer.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, and it is indeed hot, hot, hot summer there in Cincinnati, isn't it?
It's like a swamp. It's completely miserable.
Well, what do you do there in Cincinnati to stay cool during the day?
I hide in air conditioning. I have it set on snowball. So I am the pastry chef, actually, for the Palace in Cincinnati.
A pastry chef?
So, you know, I have about air conditioning for about 2 minutes, and then I go into the fiery pits of the basement and stand in front of an oven all day.
When will we be receiving our first care package from you?
Well, as soon as you give me your address.
Oh, yes.
I already offered, if you and Stephen should ever find yourself in Cincinnati, please stop by. My husband and I would love to make dinner for you.
Oh, that sounds lovely. Stephen, is, of course, one of our producers.
I know it's on your tourist destination map because you're like, France, Cincinnati.
All right. So how can we help you out today? I hope it's not a baking question because I love to cook, but I will not bake.
Well, sadly, from the previous caller, you kind of just squashed all of my hopes and dreams.
So
I don't want to borrow to fund my retirement plan, but I can completely commiserate with his impetus to pay off debt because having a debt of any kind makes me twitch. And so my husband and I had just built a home. We've been in it for about a year. We've got a good amount of equity.
Good.
And I had mentioned in passing in front of my in-laws that we had done the math and that if we spent $2,400 a month, we could have it paid off in 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
This sent my father-in-law in a tailspin. Not only is the man a two-star general, he's also an engineer, so he's right on top of always being right.
Oh, my goodness.
And he's like, are you out of your mind? He's like, your mother and I could have paid cash for this house, but we didn't because we wanted the, you know, tax deduction for the interest. And so my question was, wouldn't you ultimately be paying more in interest
Yes.
on your mortgage than you would be saving
yes.
on your taxes?
Yes, 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 yes.
Wait, does that mean you're taking my side?
No.
Am I right or is he right? Wait, who's right? Who's right?
Okay.
You're right about the math.
Yes.
But?
I tremble to contradict a two-star general, as should you, my dear. But the fact remains, most people have better things to do with their money than pay down a low-rate, tax-deductible debt, like a mortgage. For example, are you guys maxing out your retirement funds?
Well, we are maxing out our 401ks through work in terms of contributions. But then I'm, again, a little ignorant, and I didn't realize that I could be putting in up to, I think, $16,500 in my 401k.
Yep, yep.
And we did just open Roths. And I know that also now seems silly to open a Roth in addition to a 401k. But
no, it's actually smart.
Yeah.
Because one is pre-tax and one is post-tax.
Yeah.
And there are also different rules for withdrawing that money. So it's a good balance to have both a 401k and a Roth IRA.
Yeah. You want to have some balance in your life. That's what we were talking about with the Roth. If you have money in different tax brackets in retirement, you have a lot more flexibility.
You know, Liz, one thing we haven't talked about is the emergency fund,
yes.
which would, I think, probably be even before your retirement fund. How are you doing on that? Do you have a nice stash of cash for yourself?
We don't quite have 6 months of expenses.
What does your husband do?
He's also a chef. We tend to marry in our own species. Nobody else would be able to put up with it.
I'm totally coming to your house for dinner.
Oh, man.
Oh, my gosh, please. That would be so awesome.
One happy medium that you could consider is adding an extra $100 a month to your payment.
Yeah.
You know, so that you're in the end going to pay it off sooner and you won't have paid as much interest, but you're not, you know, funneling every single dollar that you have extra into that.
Yeah.
Especially when there are these other priorities.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You ladies are fabulous. Let me know where to send the cookies.
Excellent. All right. Thanks
Bye,
so
Summer.
Much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Summer. All right, and finally, we have Nick here in Upland, California. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well, thank you. We won't be talking to you about the weather.
Yes, you're familiar with the heat wave.
Yes. What do you do here in sunny SoCal?
I'm a IT consultant doing development.
So all kinds of zeros and ones for you?
I actually use the math that I took in college.
Wow.
Shocking.
Yeah.
Do your friends and family always want you to fix their computers?
Yes, yeah. But they've been such a supportive group that I'm always happy to do it.
Oh, nice. Good for you.
So how can we help you out today?
So it sounds like I'm on the beginning end of the question from your last caller. Me and my wife are hopefully looking to start our family here soon, and we are looking to buy our first home.
Oh, congratulations. Yay. That's exciting.
Thank you. But we're kind of at that point where it's, do we continue to save for a bigger down payment, or do we jump into the market, which seems pretty reasonable right now?
Well, certainly is reasonable right now, and I'm glad that I'm not hearing you go, you know, when is it going to bottom out? When is it going to bottom out? And I'm going to wait for that, because nobody knows when it's going to bottom out.
Yes.
Who knows? We may have hit it already.
Exactly.
What kind of savings do you have? I mean, do you feel like you have 20%, 30%?
No, we're not even near that right now. If we were to jump in right now, we'd be looking at some kind of FHA loan.
Okay,
probably 5-6% right now, but that is on top of, we do have a rainy day fund. That should keep us for at least 6 months if both of us, heaven forbid, were to lose our jobs.
Okay, and you have savings outside that, so you would not be raiding your rainy day fund for a mortgage.
Exactly.
So what is it about the timing now where you feel like you're in the market for a house?
Well, like I said, we've started having the family discussion where kids are going to be in the picture.
And you've thought about all the expenses that go into owning a home?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things.
Far and beyond the mortgage
payment.
Yeah,
that's one of the things. With this home, the home we're renting is actually owned by my parents, and part of the agreement is we take care of a lot of the expenses of the house.
Okay, so you've had to pay for plumbing repairs.
Yeah. So we do realize what goes into owning a home, and
okay.
It's not like renting.
Well, what do you think, Liz? You know, the only way to get a loan these days, a home loan for less than 20%, is to go through the FHA. So if they qualify for that, are you a proponent of going ahead and doing that when you basically have close to zero equity then?
I think there may be some more options if you get over 10% other than FHA.
Okay.
But I will tell you something, Nick, that's a little disturbing. The New York Times has a rent versus buy calculator on their website, which I highly encourage you to go play with.
Okay.
Because in L.A., it never makes sense to buy.
No, it doesn't seem to. I look at the rest of the home values across the country and go, wow, why not me?
Yeah, right. That's the thing. Now,
we all need to move to Cincinnati.
Oh, there we go. And that would change the dynamic. And there you go. There's economics.
Right.
So, Nick, do you guys expect to stay in the same place for 10 years or so?
Yeah, we're definitely not. We're looking to set down roots.
All right. And the fact that you've got that six-month rainy day fund actually makes me feel better, because I talk to so many people that barely scrape together the 3.5% down payment and they have nothing left over. So, you know, there's no real rush. I mean, I don't think we're going to see the real estate market suddenly heal itself and prices start to soar. So if you wanted to wait to put together a down payment, that wouldn't be, you know, an illogical choice, a bigger down payment.
Okay.
But if you wanted to jump in now, I have confidence that you would do fine. You know, the FHA loans are what's available right now. They're not super flexible, but they're more flexible than anything else that's out there. So, you know, talk to some mortgage pros about what your options would be, but with a slightly higher mortgage down payment.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not really going to get a huge payoff from saving more than 10%, then maybe it is time to jump in.
Okay. Well, we're in super saver mode right now, so we're putting away about $2,200 a month.
Okay.
Excellent.
And we need to point out the obvious thing, the risk of a low down payment, which is that you're underwater from the start.
Exactly.
You
know,
you can't sell that house.
That's a lot of people have been saying.
Yeah. You can't sell that house for what you paid for it, essentially. So you're in kind of a vulnerable position for a while.
Yeah.
Does that get you started, Nick?
Yeah.
All right. Well, if and when you do buy the house, we want you to send us a photo, okay?
Will do.
All right. Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or you can send us an email at the Getting Personal link at our website. It's marketplace.org. Liz, thanks so much. It's been fun.
My pleasure, Tess.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions.
Hands in my pocket.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name's Jessica Wagoner, and we are in front of the LA Central Library. This is my wallet. It is a gold Coach wristlet. It's bigger than a standard wallet, and this is what I have in it. Business cards, identification, credit card, chapstick, and a Swiss Army knife. I work in property management, so it makes it easy if I need to cut something open, or it also has a wine opener on it, so it's also very handy. I use the tweezers very often. I use the wine opener very often. I won it at my boyfriend's company Secret Santa thing, and it was a very fierce fight for it. Luckily, I was one of the last people, so I got to, you know, scope out all the gifts, and I ended up with this handy little sucker right here. See? Wine opener. The knife is more for, like, opening boxes or, you know, maybe jimmying locks if I need to at a building. I mean, you have to see if your building's secure, so what better way to try break in yourself?
Those of you who've tried to get your hands on a loan recently know it is not so easy these days. You need a stellar credit score, a pristine borrowing profile. If you don't have those, and many people don't in this economy, you've got a choice. Give up on the loan or turn to a funding source perhaps closer to home. But is it any better to a borrower or lender be when it's family? Michigan Radio's Jennifer Guerra reports.
So what do you do if, say, you want to buy a new house, but you haven't sold your old house yet and you need that money for a down payment? Well, if you're Pete and Michelle Baker...
Basically, we went to my parents and borrowed $40,000 from them for the down payment on the second house, hoping that, as you know, we would be able to pay them back immediately upon selling our first house.
When you broached the topic, how'd you do it?
It was definitely... a hesitant conversation.
Pete went for the easy target first, his mom, Brenda. Pete says it did not take much to convince her to give them a loan. His dad, Frank, on the other hand, was a much harder sell.
He's the one that brought up interest. He's the one that brought up structuring payments. He's the one that brought up, you know, writing out contracts and putting everything on paper, but then didn't insist on any of it. It was definitely a handshake over a beer kind of thing.
One $40,000 check later.
Hello.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I caught up with Pete and his wife at their new house. By the time I got there, the bubbly was poured, the air conditioner was on full blast, and Pete's parents, Brenda and Frank, were checking out the new digs. When I went to get Frank's take on loaning money to his son, he drops this bomb on me.
It's always dangerous to loan money to relatives. Family's too valuable to risk on a disagreement on a loan.
You heard right. Mr. Frank, $40,000 handshake Baker, says family loans are a bad idea.
If you really need that money, then you better structure it so you get it. Otherwise, don't do it.
But you didn't follow any of that advice.
Well, we don't need it to retire on. We don't need it for anything crucial in our lives. If I get paid back, that's great, but it's not worth losing a relationship over.
But what if your best friend or cousin asks you for a loan and you have the money, but unlike Frank, you actually need to get it back? Well, no surprise here. The internet has a solution. Turns out there's a growing sector of peer-to-peer lending websites. For a fee, you can use the sites to set up a formal loan with your friend or a family member. Some of the sites even let you track repayments online. There are about 10 of these social lending websites. One of them, Lending Karma, even has this hokey video to lure you in.
If you're lending or borrowing money from someone you know, Lending Karma can help ensure that your personal loan is a success.
Michael Kovacs founded Lending Karma 3 years ago. To date, 10,000 people have used the service, and he says it's just hit $500 million in loans. Unlike a bank, these sites allow borrowers and lenders to set their own terms for the loan.
The lender usually gets a better interest rate than they would if they kept their money in a savings account, and a borrower certainly gets a better rate usually than what they would from a bank.
The number one type of loan made on the site, car loans.
You know, a used car loan at 14%, you know, someone in their family can lend them that same car loan at 8%, and that's a great return.
I've lent money to my friends for cars, for helping them out when they couldn't make the rent.
That's Stephanie Landrigan. She's an instructor with UCLA Extension. She used to loan money the old-fashioned way, with a handshake or by scribbling a note on a kitchen napkin. Once, Landrigan loaned a friend of hers $5,000 so the friend could make rent. 6 months went by and no talk of repayment.
Then the seventh month, she took a vacation to Europe, which I think was on my money, which was really hurtful and also really kind of a wake-up call.
Landrigan ditched the friend, but did not ditch her desire to help people. She still loans money, but now she formalizes those loans online. She likes that her money is helping out people she knows, rather than just sitting in a bank somewhere. When I asked Landrigan if she thought more of her friends might hit her up for a loan after they heard this story, she just gave a little laugh.
Well, you know, I think that most of my friends know that I would be more than happy to help them out.
The Bank of Landrigan does have a nice ring to it. I'm Jennifer Guerra for Marketplace Money.
All right. So as we've already discussed, this was one of those weeks on Wall Street where you would have been better off, I don't know, cleaning out your septic tank than watching CNBC. But even on this crazy week, we are going to talk about investing in the stock market. Before you roll your eyes and write to us about how you don't have enough money to invest, this one is actually for you. I'm joined by Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance at Morningstar. Hi, Christine.
Tess, great to be here.
We hear from listeners pretty much every day about living paycheck to paycheck. Is there any amount too small to start investing?
I don't think so. And the fact is, by starting small and socking away small sums at regular intervals, that's a really good way to invest because you're ensuring that you're buying some stock or bonds when the prices are relatively low and maybe some when they're higher. But over time, you'll get a nice averaging effect.
But when we talk about too small, there has to be, you know, a baseline for what you need to buy a stock or a total market fund. Is that $5? Is it $10? Is it $50?
Well, I think the $50 to $100 threshold, you really start having some better investment choices. So if you are looking at an exchange-traded fund, so it's a diversified basket of securities, but it trades on an exchange throughout the day. If you're looking at an exchange-traded fund like Vanguard Total Stock Market ETF, the share price is currently about $60. You can also buy Schwab index funds for about $100. So if you have $50 to $100, you're in good shape with some decent investment choices.
Then where is the best place to start, particularly if this is something new for you? So not only do you have a lot to invest, but you really don't have a lot of even basic knowledge about where to put that money. What is the best way to get started?
So the key thing is to look for diversification. I really like the idea of getting started with a broad market index fund, but it doesn't have to be one that's U.S.-centric. So you can buy a foreign stock market index fund. If you buy a fund like that, you're essentially saying, I want exposure to the whole world. And I think that that is a really sensible way to begin investing.
But you also have to bear in mind that there are going to be fees for having that account as well, right? And that depends on what company you're using.
Right. There may be account maintenance fees that you'll pay year in and year out. You may also pay trading commissions. And that's one thing you really want to be careful about. Any commissions you pay are going to take a big bite out of your returns. So you want to try to find a platform, and thankfully there are several right now, where you can make those trades commission-free or without paying any sales charges at all.
You know, long-term unemployment is an issue for a lot of people in this country. Given that and given what that means in terms of disruption to their income, how do they think about maybe recalibrating their portfolios in order to meet their living needs?
That's a great point. To me, that probably argues for making sure that you have part of your retirement assets in very safe and steady securities. You don't want to have to raid that retirement account, but if you do, in a pinch, you won't be taking it out of stocks, which could be at a low ebb and might need time to rebound. You want to take it out of those safe and stable investments.
But, you know, when we're talking about investing and folks who don't have, you know, a couple of nickels to rub together, you probably shouldn't be doing it, for example, if you have debt.
Right. If you have debt, by far the best return on your money is going to be in retiring that debt, particularly if it's high interest rate credit card debt.
Christine Benz is Director of Personal Finance at Morningstar, an independent investment research firm in Chicago. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks. Great being here.
And for more tips for a tight budget, check out the advice from the folks at Wisebread on our Making Money blog. I took a couple of days off earlier this week, just enough for a little R&R. Lucky for me, my employer paid me for those days. I'm well aware not everyone is so fortunate, but some are even more fortunate. They have no need to monitor how many vacation days they've taken because they have an unlimited number. Ashley Milne-Tite has the story.
I've always thought Americans had a strange attitude to vacations. They just don't take them seriously enough. In Europe, a two-week summer break is the norm. Here, you may only get 2 weeks off a year. And surveys show most Americans don't even take all their vacation days. So surely, unlimited vacation can only be a good thing for one of the hardest working populations on Earth. Less time spent hunched over a desk. More time for reflection and relaxation. Vivian Valverzen was thrilled when her company, which builds health and fitness websites, made an announcement this year.
It came out of the blue on April 1st. They decided to let us know that we had an unlimited paid time off.
It wasn't an April Fool's joke. She's actually tested the policy. She went from having 2 weeks a year, including sick days, to taking several days off around July 4th. And in August...
I'm going to take an entire week off. Never would I have done this. I'm going to take an entire week off. And then I'm still going to have my week off in December to see my family.
Valverzen says she's good at managing her workload and can't wait to take advantage of the more relaxed regime. So what's in it for companies? Denise Fleury is with Mercer Health and Benefits Consulting. She points to a 2009 survey by the Society for Human Resource Management.
Two-thirds of HR professionals said that this kind of work time flexibility can increase employee morale, engagement, you know, employee satisfaction, as well as employee retention.
Corinne Sklar is Vice President of Marketing for Blue Wolf, a professional services firm with offices in San Francisco, New York, and London.
We really look at it as a part of our overall culture. And, you know, at the end of the day, the way we describe it is that, you know, we treat people like adults. We trust our employees.
That is, trust them to use the policy wisely. Employees need to manage their time well. Their goals are tracked on a weekly basis.
And so it's black and white. We know whether or not somebody is, you know, meeting their objectives.
Crystal Robarts clearly has been.
This is my actual last day in the office. I'm taking the next 4.5 weeks off to travel with my family to Europe. And we're really looking forward to it.
How could anyone object to a policy that lets you swan off on a grand tour for a month? But in fact, unlimited vacation isn't everyone's idea of bliss.
I think it's just a fallacy to think that it's always a beneficial change for the employees.
That's Yush Lee, a lawyer in Northern California. He used to work for a firm that switched from 3 weeks a year to unlimited vacation. Management said the move would mean more freedom. But the reality was Lee was so busy he could barely take off 2 weeks a year, so the new policy didn't change anything. Some co-workers felt there was another motivation.
The general consensus was that it was done purely for economics because as long as there was no vacation policy, people wouldn't be accruing vacation. So when someone left, they wouldn't have to be paid out their accrued vacation.
Not getting paid for unused vacation can be a source of resentment for some employees. Denise Fleury says that's just one hitch companies face in switching to unlimited vacation.
I think one of the biggest challenges is making sure that the policy is implemented consistently.
She says if it's not, employees in one department can end up getting more vacation days than workers in another, and resentment festers. That's not a problem at Netflix. Vice President of Corporate Communications Steve Swayze says employees are expected to work hard, but their reward is unlimited vacation, and they have no qualms about taking it.
Nobody at Netflix writes down their hours of vacation, and it's just not tracked. But we do have an intuitive sense that it's more than you took at other firms.
Blue Wolf doesn't track vacation either, but Corinne Sklar says people generally stick to around 4 weeks a year.
They're self-policing in some way, and I don't want to call it, you know, policing, but people, you know, are mature about it.
In fact, she says, even with plenty of vacation on offer, employees often have to be encouraged to take it. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
Oh, come on. Who are those people? Oh, and by the way, John McTaggart, if you're listening, I swear I would not take more than 6 weeks. Okay, maybe 8. All right. Not more than 10. So unlimited vacations are great if you have the money to go somewhere. If you don't, well, commentator Tim Bedore has been thinking about his summer break.
My 13-year-old daughter has been asking where we're going on vacation this summer, and we keep telling her, we're not sure. Should we even go on a vacation this summer? Is it economically responsible? It's that kind of year. And why go somewhere that costs money, that you have to fly for hours and hours to get to, when we can just drive to Chisago Lakes right here in Minnesota? Chisago Lakes is the little town 50 minutes north of us where my wife's family has their lake cabin. The lake cabin is what they call it, but I prefer calling it Camp Mildew. I don't call it that in front of my in-laws, and I hope they're not listening now, but between the smell of dead fish or rotting subfloor or decomposing chipmunk or God knows what, to me, it's Camp Mildew. And I'm not saying Camp Mildew isn't nice. It's relaxing to be there, even with its lack of internet access or air conditioning and potential for Lyme disease and horseflies. But here's the important thing. My daughter loves being there with her cousins, grandparents. She just loves a big family dinner outside on the deck. To her, that's just great. Why isn't the lake cabin a vacation for me? Maybe because we have equated vacations with something far away that costs money. You save up for, budget for, sacrifice for 50 weeks to earn that two-week vacation that involves airports, being groped by strangers at security. That's a vacation. As opposed to the 50-minute drive and $8.28 worth of gas that is Camp Mildew. But if that is what we do this summer, if my wife and I don't have to plan or pack, travel far, spend, how great is that? If all we have to do is bring a few bottles of wine, a few pounds of bratwurst, and their youngest granddaughter up to them, my in-laws will welcome us at Camp Mildew. And in many ways, avoiding the stress of a vacation that costs real money seems like a real vacation to me this year.
Tim Bedore is a stand-up comedian living in Minneapolis. Send us your thoughts about unlimited vacations and staycations. Post on our Facebook page or write to us at marketplace.org/money. And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to Cincinnati. Feels like we've been there already this hour, doesn't it? That's because we have. Remember, Summer called us with a question about paying off her mortgage against the advice of her father-in-law. Good for her for thinking so far ahead about getting rid of debt. But that's not why I'm giving her a pig. Remember, she's also a baker, and I am not above bribing for cookies. So how about some baked goods in exchange for plastic pork? Huh? Yeah? I think it's a fair trade. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. You can friend us and me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, the real benefit of personal finance education.
You know, this class has helped remind me what are the important things that I need to focus on. What are the goals that I want to achieve?
Gee, that sounds familiar. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.